This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Welcome to the National Museum of Australia. And welcome to the last in our lecture series. Who has come with us through this entire journey? Oh, yep, there's a few of you. Good, good. It's been a wonderful opportunity for us to really start to explore this culture that, as myself and my team, haven't had a lot of exposure to in the past. So it's been, professionally, the most wonderful learning opportunity. And personally, it's been absolutely incredible. I've been to iftar dinners. I've been to a mosque. I've been to a whole lot of places I've never been before. I've been shown such grace and kindness and enthusiasm by this culture that I know that I've been changed personally about this. And even though I've only been exposed to a very small part of this community, I do know it's something that I'm going to take with me for the rest of my life. It's just been amazing. Now, in the spirit of interfaith and understanding that this is the core of this exhibition, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of our land. I'd like to acknowledge the land on which we meet and their vibrant and ongoing culture. Well, I've got a bit of a treat for you today. Today we've got Dr. Sam Balker. Oh, and before I go any further, I'd really like to acknowledge Mum and Dad Balker as well. It doesn't matter how old you are. Your parents always like to come to these sort of things. So it's lovely to have you both again. Sorry, that's not part of my introduction. So, Dr. Sam Balker. It's a great treat. I've seen Sam speak a couple of times now, and the really funny thing about putting Sam in this lecture series is every time I've mentioned his name, it doesn't matter who, too, people go, oh, I love him. So hoping you're really going to enjoy this talk. Now, Sam is a lecturer in art history and visual culture at Charles Sturt University. Prior to joining Charles Sturt University, he's given me quite the list. He's worked at the National Portrait Gallery, the National Museum, and lectured in art theory at the ANU School of Art. So he seems to have been everywhere. You never know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. His current major research project is an art historical survey of, oh dear, Sam, help me.
Kayamiya.
The Tentmakers of Art. It sounds fabulous. I know that Mrs. Balker was telling me a lot about it at the iftar dinner we went to. It is just a really interesting topic. I know you're going to enjoy this one. And thank you so much for coming. And please join me in welcoming Dr. Sam Balker.
Thank you very much, Hardy, for that warm and welcoming introduction. Very kind of you. It is a privilege to see everyone here today. I'd just like to acknowledge, or to begin, by acknowledging that this presentation was written on Wiradjuri land in Wagga Wagga. It is a privilege to speak today on the land of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and I pay respect to the custodians of this region as we meet here today. Now, let's just bring up my first opening text. Here we go. I have to say thank you very much to the National Museum of Australia for making this possible, because this exhibition, So That You May Know Each Other, is exceptional as a representation of Islamic arts from Australian perspectives, something that the world sees all too little of. So what I find particularly impressive about this show is the way it gathers from three major collections, the Vatican Museum Authority, the Sharjah Museum, and the National Museum of Australia, amongst others, to bring together an exhibition that is geographically and culturally diverse, that contests the use of the term Islamic art in favour of a much more polyvaried display of culture, material culture, textiles, music, and other language forms. And it goes beyond the idea that Islamic art is centred specifically in Arabic, Turkish, and Persian regions, to include the Philippines, to include South India and, South Asia, and, of course, Australia, amongst others. So it's an ambitious show. This lecture will begin with taking objects and points of interest from the exhibition, which I hope you've had the chance to see. If not, don't worry, this will introduce you to my personal highlights from the show. It will then expand on their context as a leaping point. So let's explore. This is a quick overview of how we'll take the next 45 minutes. We'll talk briefly about the formation of Islamic art collections and the drives that underpin their creation and why they form into the shapes that we have in our exhibition downstairs. I'll talk about the vernacular problem, which is something that we see all too little of in international surveys of Islamic art, but we do see in this exhibition, which is a very useful thing for us. I'll briefly go into amulets and protection through several forms, then into remarkable ceramics from Turkey, from Iran, and into religious objects on metal, paper, and in water. From there, stories and textiles, focusing on works which are present in the exhibition and absent from it, and also woodwork through a couple of more unusual pieces in our display. Overall, one of the key themes that runs through this discussion is the importance of the souvenir, the contested nature of heritage within the expanded and unwieldy field of Islamic art, and the constant adaptation that we see throughout this history into the present day. And there I'll briefly talk about my favourite pet subject, Kayamiya, Egyptian tentmaker applique, which is not specifically shown in this exhibition, but is shown in the corollary exhibition of contemporary Australian art over at the Nishi Galleries in the work of Lila Alrez. So, and a Q&A, of course, so please save questions for the end. I love questions, and I will do my best to answer them for you. So on to collecting Islamic arts. I want to think about what the drive is that causes a genre called Islamic art to come into existence, remembering that this is a genre that covers the largest chronological and geographic survey of all art history's terms. It is big and massive, going from southern Spain all the way to the Philippines and Australia, going from 7th century to the present day. And it is contested as a matter of whose language is best representative of Islamic art. Which region defines it? Is it the place where Islam originated or the place where it is most populous today? Is it a form that we as Western non-Muslim curators can impose upon the arts of other people because it helps us file them more efficiently, the great miscellany? Or is it something which is empowering and used by Muslim artisans as a sense of identity and a statement of faith? So these are the contestations. One of the ways that collections form is through the act of tourists bringing things home from travels abroad. And the examples we have here on this exhibition, the Druze dagger from the Golan Heights region and the nargile, or hookah, also called a hubbly bubbly, these are items that we might expect to see brought back from travels to distant far-off lands, imbued with the exotic. Yet they are a piece, each to their own, which is relevant and pertinent to the traditions that formed them. They have meaning. They are used in daily life. They are vernacular objects enhanced for the tourist gaze. And subsequently, they are collected and retained and displayed as items of importance. So in this drive, this orientalizing, othering drive, we end up with accumulations of material culture that have certain biases towards the beautiful, the luxurious, the expensive. And this is at the heart of all the major Islamic art collections in museums around the world, be they formed by individuals or with the benefits of archaeological sites and significant excavation surveys which go much deeper into the histories of specific places, languages, and cultures. And Islamic art has a prevalence on our daily lives we don't necessarily even expect. What I'm showing you right now is an Ottoman coffee set, a cup holder in sheer porcelain, which if you poured boiling liquid into it would be too hot to touch. So they developed the zarf, which in this case, apart from being a beautiful word, is a gem-encrusted cup holder, basically. The zarf is still the name used by graphic designers developing disposable cup labels or keep cup bands, which are now used to hold your coffee separate to your fingers. It is still called the zarf, and that is a term from Ottoman Turkey, which, of course, is one of the great sources of European coffee cultures. So these forms influence us in daily life. That word coming from Turkish is still used. We in Australia have a number of major philanthropists, scholars, and collectors of Islamic art. Now, I'm not trying to name all of them here. It would take quite a while. But I wanted to shout out to three particularly important figures in the philanthropy of Islamic arts in Australia. Barry and Judith Heaven, who opened the first tandoori restaurant in Australia, Have the main philanthropist to the Art Gallery of South Australia, collecting major works which I then donate to the gallery for public benefit. John Bowman formed an extraordinary collection of manuscripts as a former professor of Semitic languages from a variety of, I think, about 9 different language groups, which are now held in the Bailiou Library after some 60 years of never being opened. They're only just now being conserved and made available to scholars. I was at a conference in Melbourne last week revealing these and encouraging academics to get their postgraduate students onto these things. Quick smart. And also William Bowmore, whose work has been as a particular collector of ceramics throughout his life, becoming an established scholar in this field, then bequeathing his collection to the Art Gallery of South Australia, which is today Australia's leading museum for the continual display of historic Islamic arts, which are otherwise quite simply absent from the Australian museum sector. So that's another reason why the show like this is so very important to us now. We don't have a Frederick Leighton in Australia. These are the collectors who took Islamic art not only seriously but made it their life's work. Leighton, of course, was an artist and an inveterate traveller. He was successful and built with this legacy a renovation of the ground floor of his home into a model styled upon a Syrian Ajami room with a combination of influences from different places. If you walk into this place, you will find references to Iran, to Turkey, to Syria, to Mamluk Cairo. There's a variety of different blends of cultures mishmashed into this London apartment or mansion. But the thing I particularly like within it, I don't know if you can see it clearly. Can you see my mouse up there? Yes. Just up here are sulfur-crested cockatoos in the mosaics, a very unexpected detail, which is, of course, the product of these fantasies coming from a serious interest in collectors' interest of the Orient, as it was then called, becoming the collector's own statement. Similarly, in Doris Duke's Shangri-La, her mansion in Honolulu, Doris Duke was an incredibly wealthy heiress to a tobacco company and a philanthropist for causes of health, music education, and Islamic art, formed from a 2-year honeymoon across North Africa, the Middle East, and India, where as she travelled, she said, "I like that building, let's take it home," and gradually accumulating room upon room, like a museum in Honolulu, of all places, which she took as a private refuge from the world's paparazzi, and building Shangri-La, which is now a house museum that very much champions the cause of contemporary arts addressing Islamic themes in America today. Doris Duke Shangri-La also contains 3 Ajami rooms from Syria, which I feel is something that Australia might wish to consider one day. We do not possess an Ajami room in any Australian museum. Many were packed up and dismantled in the 1950s from Damascus and Aleppo as a result of people building concrete new apartments in the inner cities of these regions. These rooms are still in circulation, dismantled and ethically sourced through originally Armenian antiques dealers. I would love one day to see one of these reach Australia as a part of an ongoing display of Islamic arts in historical forms. But that, of course, is magnificent and glorious and designed to impress. These are the things that we find regularly in collections of Islamic art. What we don't see is one of perhaps the most important forms which this exhibition champions, the vernacular. Items of everyday life made of rudimentary materials for a purpose immediately at hand, which I think characterises the work of the Afghan cameliers seen here in this unique, to my understanding, camel saddle made for Australian transportation across the deserts of Central Australia, and that cast iron cauldron recovered in 1909 from a beach in the Northern Territory as material evidence, not that we needed more of it, of the interaction between the Macassans as traders and the indigenous peoples of Australia who traded trepang, sea cucumbers, across these shores. I'm also expanding this with another example of the overlooked vernacular, a norag, a threshing sled, minus the wheels that actually thresh the grain, from Egypt, which is completely omitted from any history of Islamic or Egyptian art. The importance of the vernacular has been recognised by contemporary Australian artists. Again, over in the Nishi Gallery, Shireen Tawil can be seen, or smaller versions of her work, in copper, where she looks upon the ways in which copper was shaped and smithed by artisans across the Islamic world, perhaps for want of alternative terms, And in this case, looking upon the patterns of wallpapers found in the early mushallas, which are like temporary mosque spaces. They're sanctuaries for prayer that aren't quite mosques, but something in between, a temporary traveller's destination. Looking closely at the pattern from the suspended piece here, we can see that simplicity, that idea which is formed from a vernacular aesthetic, but yet contemporary art in the setting. So these forms have been championed and recognised, but when we consider the role of things like the norag, they were agricultural equipment. How can this be art? It's basically a tractor. Well, some people like their tractors. But if we look very carefully at the forms used here, they are imbued with design ethos that comes from, in this case, North African forms. We are looking here at patterns and evocations, including inscriptions that dedicate the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, the Bismillah, to a particular individual who is named, Majid Yusuf Makhan, who is made this in 1959, and with the help of Allah, a swift victory. So there is dedication, there is the use of daily life imbued with religious context, and the forms are inextricable. How can we not call this a manifestation of Islamic art if it is framed specifically within a mindset that is Islamic? It was recognised, of course, by Orientalists, but not necessarily by curators. This brings us again to that other vernacular object in this collection, the Macassan cauldron. When I looked at this, I thought, what a great bucket. It is rusty, it is deteriorated, and it is made in most rudimentary forms. There's no calligraphy on it anywhere. I looked closely. When we look at this, however, and think about the other buckets in Islamic art history, the most famous is the Bobrinsky bucket, which is held in the State Museum, the Hermitage, in Russia, St. Petersburg. So when we are looking at the Bobrinsky bucket, we have all the reasons why it would be collected over the Macassan cauldron. We have, of course, tigers on the handles. We have zoomorphic calligraphic forms and anamorphic calligraphic forms. Using the mouse again, you can see there is calligraphy through here, but looking above, those form the legs and heads of figures that are talking, interacting, and working together. So they're personified. There's figurative art within this, which might be a surprise to some of us. We are also looking here at a form that is collected by its preciousness, by its beauty, and the importance given to that, as opposed to what we now see as an important interaction between cultures. The Bobrinsky bucket, by the way, there have even been attempts to remove the vulgar term bucket from its title, to use the Roman alternative situla. But the Bobrinsky situla, no one could imagine what that looked like, so they went back to Bobrinsky bucket. But this reminds me of something very important. If we are thinking about the way we prioritise certain forms in Islamic art, let's think about how we prioritise bronzes in Australian art history. The Bermagui bronze. When I think of the Bobrinsky bucket and the Macassan cauldron, this immediately comes to mind. I don't know if any of you remember The Late Show from 1993. No? Some of us? Well, the Bermagui bronze, I'll let it explain for itself with exactly 1 minute, which is very relevant to our understanding of Islamic art.
The passion.
Wasalami, Papi! Wasalami! Wasalami, Barry! Oh, the Iron Man! Your brother's an Iron Man! Your mum's an Iron Man! We're all Iron Man! And what have we got in common? We're all bags of Bermagui bronze! And now it's your turn! Go out there and come third! Come third like a real Australian athlete!
The excitement.
Joe, just got the test results from the Institute. They reckon Barry might come second, or even worse, win.
Bugger the Institute, Jock! Bugger him! Barry's my son! If I see him win the bronze, he bloody well can!
The romance.
Joe, you'll have to choose. It's either me, or the Bermagui bronze.
Listen, babe. I'm not just doing this for me and Barry. I'm doing this for everyone in this big, round, flat, mysterious, crazy country who knows what it means to come third for Australia.
The Bermagui bronze.
So from the Bobrinsky bucket to the Bermagui bronze, I hope you agree that was an appropriate segue. And the act of the iron cauldron in that mysterious, great land of ours. And the act of throwing water on people is our lateral segue to Egyptian terracotta forms for carrying water. I know, thank you very much. I was so happy to come up with the use of a late show in my lecture. But this, again, is that problem with the vernacular and how we prioritise certain forms at the bias of others. These are illustrated in the catalogue for this exhibition, and they're quite widely seen in collections of Islamic art or Middle Eastern ceramics around the world. The reason for this is that they are, number one, a fairly strong part of the pot. They are quite dense, they're protected, they're not as fragile as the parts below and above. They are designed to literally filter sediment out of water upon being poured. But they survive because they're beautiful. Imagine all the sherds that you see across sites like in Jordan at Pella, across the surface of the ground, which you shouldn't pick up, but people do. And we prioritise the beautiful ones. So this is the reason that they survive. The imaginative part of the pot persists. The parts that are not so elegantly thought through and sophisticated do not survive. And within these we find puns, we find dedications, we find sheer flights of whimsy. And this is the beautiful thing about Islamic arts. We preserve what makes us human. And, of course, our contemporary artists respond to this. In the spirit of the dialogue of objects, Ibrahim Said is a well-known Egyptian contemporary ceramicist. He makes vessels, but primarily he makes sculptures. And these forms are very much indebted to those filigree patterns that we find in the work of the Egyptian terracotta filters by anonymous artisans from many centuries previous. We have in this exhibition as well a beautiful collection of objects that support international trade, like the iron cauldron or the macassans. The pearl scales and sieves, however, were infrastructure of a much more luxurious market. We can find the pearls that were traded through these objects in jewellery, in tent embroideries, in brooches and religious objects, as well as secular objects that were traded much further afield and transformed into forms that would not be recognised by Islamic artisans. But where in this exhibition are the pearls? There's currently a couple of different efforts on the theme of maritime arts of Islam as an understudied area. There's two books recently published, including the work of Avinu and Shoalem, and also the next coming up conference in Qatar by the Hamad bin Khalifa Foundation, which is on the sailing arts of Islam, things that have travelled across the seas to be the art forms. But let's see what these pearls look like. Not necessarily the same kinds of pearl that were traded by the traders in Sharjah, but an example of the ways in which natural materials are adapted and used within Islamic meaningful cultures, material and spiritual cultures. The forms that we have here, I've just shown you the same shell two times. It's approximately the size of my hand, 15 centimetres across. The text is three different parts of the Quran, the opening verse, and two other parts that refer to health and well-being, amongst other things. And right in the centre, very hard to see, just in here, is a collection of what can be described as magic numbers. The idea behind this is it would most likely be washed with water, which would then take on the sacred qualities of the Quran as direct text from God, and then imbibed to cure illness, to work with the body, to work with the mind and the spirit. It's a way of basically creating a form of holy water and subsequently used to improve one's physical and spiritual well-being. So this idea of what could be called superstition or the supernatural elements, the idea of interacting with the divine, is a key part of objects we might call Islamic art in reference to the original cultures that are using them, not a term which has been laid on by subsequent curators. In exactly that note, the quality of amulets that we see in this exhibition. There's a beautiful collection here of West African amulets worn just around the corner on the left as you enter into the gallery space. And this contains text from the Quran in that five little segments together. Now, these are worn as a protective device. It is quite common to wear elements of Quranic text as things like paper garments, as jewellery, on armour and weapons as a supernatural protection as well as a protection against more physical antagonists. We also see this carried in the work of contemporary jewellers. What I'm showing you now is an example by Azar Fahmi, the designer responsible for my wedding ring, amongst other things, this, you know, conflict of interest disclaimer, whose work is frequently drawing upon Egyptian heritages that source their materials from Nubian cultures in the south of Egypt, from Islamic and Pharaonic cultures subsequently, and Egyptian folkloric culture to the present day. So these amulets contain text and calligraphy from a variety of sources, sometimes partial, sometimes complete. This also brings us to another object in this collection which may be easily overlooked, so I want to pay very close attention to it now. The Kutuya ceramics are a coffee set, the kind of thing you might even potentially have in your home. It's not unforeseeable that you might find something like this as a souvenir on a trip to Turkey today, even. But let's remember that these are Kutaya ceramics, not Iznik ceramics, which are perhaps far more well-known. Iznik ceramics are the ones we associate with the Rustem Pasha Mosque, the Blue Mosque in Istanbul, as vast walls of floral colour and pattern. Kutaya ceramics are made by primarily Armenian Christians, and they're much more household. They're more typical of things you'd actually use in day-to-day life, rather than catering for elite patrons and major architectural sites. So in Australia, our most spectacular Kutaya ceramics are the fireplace of the Art Gallery of South Australia, which is pretty much a permanent installation in that room. And you can see how the wallpaper of this gallery at the time it was displayed in this photograph is evoking those Kutuya ceramics. Or actually, pardon me, the wallpaper is evoking an Iznik ceramic. The Kutuya ceramic is the fireplace itself. The difference is often a kind of formality and disciplined edge of the line. Kutaya ceramics have a somewhat more rough quality, by comparison only. But the fireplace here is interesting, because the anecdote holds, and is still told by the curators there today, that when it was purchased, they thought they were buying a mihrab. And this is funny because a mihrab is a very important object within Islamic material culture. It is the niche that directs praying Muslims towards Mecca. You find it in every mosque. And it's always oriented specifically in the direction you need to be pointing, the Qibla, towards Mecca. Now, ending up with a fireplace instead of a mihrab is maybe a forgivable mistake. But let's have a look at what a mihrab actually looks like. There's a niche, but there's no chimney. Big difference. And there's also a very different use of text. A mihrab will typically have Quranic text in elegant calligraphy, very carefully refined and considered. Our fireplace doesn't need that. And indeed, the Kutaya fireplace in Adelaide does not have any calligraphy. But interestingly, no one's ever written a thesis about it. And I think that'd be a great topic for an honours or master's student in the future one day, inshallah. As we're looking at this form, the mihrab in the Metropolitan Museum is one of those defining objects that makes a collection. It's like an Ajami room. If you want to have a really serious world-class collection of Islamic arts, you've got to have a mihrab somewhere. And I remember there's some degree of contention over whether the Metropolitan mihrab was actually facing Mecca and could be used or not in the original display space. More examples of the fireplaces, though, just because they're interesting. This has appeared more recently at auction. This is a different one to our Adelaide version, of course, shown in 1950 and 2017, sold by Bonham's Auction House both times, and also depicted in the work of the Turkish Orientalist painter Osman Hamdi Bey, a diplomat and archaeologist who used to my understanding, accept bribes for certain digs to be excavated in exchange for the purchase of his paintings, subsequently resulting in many of his paintings ending up in American university art museum collections, where they were disregarded until quite recently. So interesting little curiosity about how they ended up in their collections. But not only fireplaces are still for sale. This is an ancient, and by ancient I mean 14th century, monumental mihrab collection of panels, most likely from Isfahan in Iran, from the Timurid period. So one of the most important periods of the great building dynasties of Islamic arts, along with the Ilkhanids. Now, when we are seeing this work here, it is being sold. It was found in a French country house where it had been collected by a patron like Lord Leighton, someone like that, and it was sold for an estimate 300,000 British pounds. It sold for 1.2 million British pounds. Such is the power here of the Middle Eastern collecting market for museums in the Qatar region, in Dubai, areas like that, where private collectors and museums in those places are rapidly buying back major items of heritage. So they're seen as strong investments, and this is the problem Australia now faces. If we want a serious collection of the kind of elite arts of Islam, the courtly arts, we are now outpriced. I don't think we'll see this happen in Australia. We do have these, however. In our exhibition downstairs, one of these things is not like the others. That's ours, the red one. Now, this is a collection of panels resembling mihrabs, and you'll note the common themes in each one. The presence of calligraphy, the presence of the hanging lamp, which is often connected to a Quranic verse on Allah is the light of heaven and earth, which is written quite frequently on glass lamps like these. We occasionally also see incense burners in these positions in mihrabs. But the idea here is you didn't need a grand mihrab to establish the spiritual role of the object in orienting you towards Mecca. A single tile or a temporary textile would also do the job. Remember that in none of these cases is the mihrab itself technically sacred. It is an earthly object. It directs you to a place that is sacred. The orientation is important, not the actual wall you're facing. So from here. Another example of these objects that are blending the sacred and the profane, the daily life, is an example of a thing called a hilya. Hilya is a Turkish term. But that is to say, I haven't seen these objects being described in Arabic. I've only seen them in Turkish. I'd be happy to be proven wrong, however, or Persian for that matter. Hilya are descriptions of the attributes of the Prophet Muhammad, where they talk about his physical appearance, his personality, his descriptions of his even his scent, of his breath and so on, the colour of his hair, his beard, etc. We have probably a more consistent idea of the appearance of that figure than we do of Jesus, through if you take these hilya as legitimate, accurate accounts. They are more consistently repeating the actual statements of the physical qualities of this individual. And what I have here is the one we have in our exhibition, which I'll come to in a moment, but a different one, this little bottle, which is a really curious object. To my understanding, I think less than six of these are known to exist today, and they were all made in the Ottoman Empire over the past couple of centuries, and they're now held in the Topkapi Palace archives. They are bottles that were used like that vessel, like the pearl shell vessel, to take in water, often Zamzam water, which is a sacred water to begin with, hence Zamzamiyah, the holder of Zamzam water. And they are reverse glass painted. So here we have a description of the attributes of the Prophet written on glass from the inside of the painting vessel, which is then layered upon itself to create a full scroll on the interior text. So these are very unusual objects. They're currently being studied by Christiane Gruber as part of her ongoing studies into the representations of the Prophet Muhammad. We also have in the example here today the illumination around that calligraphy. Actually, just a quick note on the calligraphy. It is really impressive that this exhibition does not place great emphasis on calligraphy as a source of importance for understanding the cultures we are studying. Calligraphy is essentially the highest of Islamic arts alongside architecture, but it's tricky for us to read, as many Australians will find. So the downplaying of its significance through the alternative ways of understanding Islamic material culture, through music, through trade, through food and interactions of people and textiles, is really a very innovative and typically Australian approach. I find this really rewarding. But look very carefully at one patch of the illumination here. You'll see four blue squares. If you look extremely closely at those, perhaps in the object itself downstairs later, you'll see that's flowing water. These are evocations of a garden, in which water itself is, of course, a very important aspect, moving water more so still. What we're seeing here is a garden from the courtyards of the Alhambra complex in southern Spain. So this is an example which I think was being referenced by the illustrator or the illuminator of that manuscript, who was not necessarily the same person as the calligrapher. But this brings us to the ways in which Muhammad is represented. A hilya again, but over in Nakara, South Australia, we have one of many actual portraits, or purported portraits, of Muhammad, depicted as a human-like figure, riding Barak in this case. Now, these are surprisingly common, but people choose to deny their existence because it does not fit very well with the widely held understanding that there is no figuration within Islamic religious art spaces. This was not necessarily for a religious art space. You would not put an image like this in a mosque, but it would have been used in spaces outside. Christiane Gruber's work, which I really salute as one of, I think, the bravest Islamic art historians working today in Turkey and America, has dedicated extensive research to the ways in which Muhammad as a figure is represented through hilya text, through metaphor, through metonym, and also through portrayals like this, which include the face. There are other forms, perhaps more well-known to you, where the figure is veiled or ensconced in fire as an alternative to trying to show an earthly presence. But this is a really interesting object for these reasons. It does sit within the heritage of Islamic art to portray Muhammad. It is simply very unusual and increasingly rarely seen today. Another interaction here between the forms of Islamic art and other cultures, an extremely famous object, the Baptistry of St. Louis in the Louvre Museum in Paris. Now, this is an example which again shows us the importance of figuration in Islamic art, something which we also see in our exhibition downstairs, where figurative works depicting people are quite common, or fairly common in that show. The figures here include hunting dogs, gazelles, cheetah, and I believe it's a female lion supporting this fellow with an archer on the back of the horse here as he moves through the sequence of events. Hunting was a very important trope within Islamic art images in this sense. We're looking here at the idea of miniatures, metalwork, stories like the Shahnameh, in which hunting is important, partly because for a courtly patronage art form, you're dealing here with a moment where a ruler, an influencing figure, is travelling through their territories, reviewing the state of the nation, understanding the course of their people, and seeing how things are going generally, like checking in as a politician almost. And the hunting scene, therefore, is a part not only of the thrill of a chase, but of an interaction with subjects at a time when they're more likely to see them than they are in the palace. Another particularly important object alluded to but not in this exhibition are the keys to the Kaaba. The Kaaba, of course, being the very important black cube in the centre of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. The key to the Kaaba is displayed in the bag, which is held here in this exhibition, the green bag with the gold embroidery. But the keys to the Kaaba take many forms. They are passed down as an inherited role of guarding the keys within just one family, but the keys transfer from time to time. They are remade and given as gifts to the most important dignitaries involved in the Hajj pilgrimage. So the keys have changed over time. The Hajj pilgrimage, of course, is one of the most important collections for the study of Islamic material cultures and visual cultures as a representation for pilgrims who are making maps to how to study and go there, for the textiles associated with the mahmal, which is the pavilion transported by camel, which purportedly held the wrappings of the Kaaba, the kiswa cloth, which is the black shape with gold embroidery you see here in this image. And Professor James Piscatori recently spoke for the museum on the art of the Hajj, and shortly the Australian National University will be hosting a visit by Venetia Porter, who is the major curator of the British Museum and great scholar of the art of the Hajj pilgrimage. That will be held at the ANU in a few months' time. Back to our exhibition, the notion of the hunt continues with this Iranian block-printed textile, one of my favourite things here. A favourite thing because I love the animated expressions between the figures, the gestures, the body language, and those great shoes and pants, really, wonderful socks. Or boots, pardon me. So as we're considering these forms, something I want to bring to your attention is just a little thing, a charming thing. I do this for Heidi. Over here, the dog in the middle of the scene. A hunting dog once again, a very charming, devoted fellow, running between the hooves of the person in charge's horse. But dogs are surprisingly common in the history of Islamic arts. We find them usually in hunting scenes as allies and patrons, this being a saluki. We find a number of different forms over time. Remember, dogs have a situation here which means they can be portrayed and respected. The problem is that we don't associate with them before prayer. They are seen as a different point of interaction then. But they are respected as working animals. But that textile before from the Iranian print, note the structure. Three groups of figures leading up with different events occurring at each stage. This reminds me of a very important tapestry woven in Egypt by the Ramses Wissawassef Center. And I share this with you as a very short story about how individual stories can be invested in otherwise anonymous works. This one, luckily, we do know her name and it is recorded on the textile as a recent work. But it was made or started shortly after she underwent a breakdown in her relationship, her marriage. And feeling rejected and despondent, the work begins with a depiction of horrible crawling things, worms, scorpions, spiders and rats, because, of course, you weave gradually building up from the base in this case. Then, as her attitudes began to change, she went through the trouble of divorce. The battle scene was formed from the base up as people are fighting and contesting the control. But then gradually a new relationship forms and she leaves in the sunset with a man on a white horse. So this is a form of a personal biography invested into the making, the process of the artwork. And it's possible that we know this because we are talking to the individual today who's telling this story. A great many of these stories have been lost in the history of Islamic arts, where the artisans usually deferred their name in favour of the patron who was commissioning it. The main artisans we know of today are the calligraphers who had the privilege of writing their name if it was deemed worthy as such, usually in the most humble terms. And that brings us to another small and interesting object in this exhibition. Just for comparison, I've scaled the door of Zanzibar to approximate the size it is in our exhibition as a small souvenir compared to the original doors of Zanzibar Stone Town. I love these things. I very nearly wrote my honours thesis on them before I realised it was impossible to supervise that topic from Australia. But the doors of Zanzibar represent a blending of cultures from Gujarat and India along the Swahili coast of Africa and Arab traders from Omani coast and the Red Sea, the Gulf states. So in these forms of wood carving, we see a blend of references between the local mahoganies and teaks to the text in Arabic, the floral forms from India and Gujarat, and details which are quite specific to the region they are from. In this case here, those iron or brass knobs are essentially protection against elephants. Elephants have never existed on the island of Zanzibar. You don't need them, but they're pretty, and they're a status object. And interestingly, and of course an elephant wouldn't press its head against it, hence it does, a small point offers enough protection to stop it being battered down. In India, they would be used as legitimate protection on citadels and the like. But now they are all too frequently souvenired, vandalised, stolen and sold in antique shops. The doors themselves are frequently in a state of poor repair, although they are one of the reasons why Stone Town in Zanzibar is regarded as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. You have a contradiction here. There are hotels that have sold the old impressive door from the mansion in order to fund the restoration of the mansion and buy a new replacement door from contemporary artisans who are keeping the art form alive with the funds proceeded by selling the original door to a mansion somewhere in France, like that Timurid Mihreb panel we saw earlier. How does this sit with the living culture of the place? You're still employing the artisans, you're keeping the craft alive, you've lost the original door that visitors came to see to stay in your hotel for. So these are the complications and implications of these objects being valued as something other than vernacular. Also, the chain patterns here. The chain patterns have been described in sources I've read where they talk about this as a protection against evil spirits, a threat to enslave and ensnare anything that comes through without permission. But they also echo to Zanzibar's history as a slave trading centre. These doors were paid with proceeds from the ivory trade and the slave trade, amongst other nicer things, like the trade in spices and cloves. So all part of the contested histories here. That was an example, again, of making the doors to go in the hotels once again. That's an original door, but they're frequently copied to create newer forms. Another very small detail within the exhibition I think is very important is the Meshrabiyya lattice that appears in the base of this Quran stand. I'm showing it to you because blinking you'll miss it. You'll be distracted by the beautiful geometric forms, the shining mother-of-pearl surfaces, and the impressive manuscripts nearby, as you should be. They're beautiful things. But the Meshrabiyya pattern here is evoking the use of this art form in spaces where it is not necessarily expected, as objects that were sold for interiors and the tourist collector. You don't technically need a Meshrabiyya there for the object to be functional. You need it to help the object sell well to the appealing eye. The Meshrabiyya screens were originally used as windows, latticework frames. In India, there's an equivalent called the Jali, which is carved from red stone most frequently. But these are turned wood sticks, literally sticks, which slot together to create complex patterns held together by the frame. There's no nails or glue involved. But these forms, very complex as they are, enable you to see outside the house without being able to see in. It's the same idea as you have when you turn a light on at night in an apartment window. You can see inside if the room inside is bright. You can see outside if the room outside is bright. And otherwise you have a reflection. In this case, there are no glass required. It enables ventilation of air to move through. But notice the way in which patterns have been invested by simply adding additional turn spikes, folded pieces of wood within others. This has been adapted by contemporary artists once again. Susan Hifuna's Knowledge is Sweeter Than Honey is a series of works where she creates texts in Arabic and English, which are often politically provocative, sometimes drawn from song lyrics, sometimes drawn from protest banners, where she creates statements about her position as a woman and a contemporary artist as well, remembering that the Meshrabiyya are gendered objects. They are seen as containing women's spaces onto the public space, which is a male space. Historically speaking, they are a loaded object this way, meaningfully. but from one encompassing space to another, the idea of the Mesh Rabir screen has informed other artists. And this is the work of Anila Khayyam Agha, Intersections, probably the most Instagrammed piece of contemporary art of this genre you might encounter. But why not? The work itself is basically a very large covered lamp, which forms patterns and evocations around any space to transform it, using the white cube gallery as a space that enables not only the display of an object, but the transformation of an object. It challenges the idea that Islamic arts are taken as a thing by Western curators and put into a space, but claiming the space that they are placed within. A really impressive action. And, of course, this is her most well-known work, but if you Google her name and look at her other works on her own website, you will encounter a very wide variety of these, including the drawings that inform them, that are all part of her practice and sold as her work. This is simply her most well-known manifesto piece. But on that notion of the immersive environment, I want to connect this lecture to one final object in the display downstairs and my own personal favourite field, Khayyamiyya. This is an Ottoman tent collected at the siege of Vienna in 1683 and subsequently traded as war loot from point to point around Europe. The work of Ashley Dimmig, who's studying a PhD right now, I think she's nearly finished, is looking at the afterlife of Ottoman tents. My interest in them, however, is the question of where the Ottoman tent makers interact with the Egyptian tent makers. We don't have one of these in Australia, but we do have one of these. This metal thread textile is the first object you see as you enter the exhibition space downstairs. And what a magnificent choice. It is shining, it is lustrous, it is complex and immersive. It is ornate and intricate. It is carefully stitched by hand to form these patterns and shapes which are evocative of so many other conversations within Islamic visual culture. But the form itself, I think it evokes what became Egyptian Khayyamiyya. Look at the composition. Note the forms in the borders, note the corners within the centre, and that use of a strong central motif. Look at the places where calligraphy appears. Doesn't matter if you can't read it, note where it is. Now compare this with the forms that were made in Egypt around the same time. This is the sign panel, the first Khedival Khayyamiyya to be discovered in Australia. And I think what's happening here is the artisans are remembering a common heritage of the tent makers' forms, be they Ottoman imperial patrons or local Egyptian patrons, and working then with the cheaper approach rather than individual metal threads and embroidery, which is time-consuming and expensive in materials and labour, to the labour costs with just cotton appliqué in minimal colours, making it far more affordable. We're seeing here a very different response to place that is losing none of the meaning and ethos of the original object. I've translated here for you the text, which could be read in any direction. This thing has no particular right side up. It would have been used as a modular panel, a ceiling or a wall most likely, maybe an awning, at a public event, be it the performance of musicians, the reading of texts, sacred or otherwise, or hosting of weddings, wakes at funerals, graduations, events like this, public events. So these texts are very much the kind of thing we expect to find in the epigrams of Islamic art. Eva Bayer, in her book on Islamic metalwork, described the entire genre of Islamic metalwork as a field of objects that sing and laugh. And I thought that was a beautiful way of remembering the importance of calligraphy on these as an expressive aspect. These are bringing me to my final points about the ways in which Islamic art adapts over time. From the great Khedival panels of the tent makers of Cairo are made for local audiences that can properly be called Egyptian art or Islamic art in the sense that they are of their time and of their place. The touristic panels that follow were being made for a Western gaze. They're collected by the Anzacs, by nurses, by soldiers in World War I and World War II and distributed around the world, as were the former, the Khedival forms, but only by the wealthier visitors who had enough space to display them or ambitions to do so. These panels are far more common. We even have them up in regional Australia near Wagga Wagga in Gan, Maine, at the local museum. Through their contemporary forms, which have scaled down to approximate ratio of size, which are colourful, vibrant, and immaculately made as contemporary art for contemporary interiors, no longer architectural, no longer necessarily writing in Arabic with original folkloric statements, but ideas that have rationalised the importance of lessons from the past into the present day. And now, as artists are turning and referring to this heritage. I'm showing you my very last slides, the work of Rachid Karachi, Algerian artist who exhibits widely around the world in collaboration with artisans across North Africa. Rachid Karachi developed these calligraphic forms which evoke vernacular and Sufist ideas amongst other grand traditions within the Islamic arts, and created a series of works called The Invisible Masters, which is paying tribute in a manner quite like the recent Frontier Wars exhibition down in Melbourne. Has anyone seen this yet as part of Colony? If not, I highly recommend it. In the black room of the Frontier Wars exhibition is a collection of shields and paraphernalia from Indigenous Australians scattered in mounds like middens, with museum labels, actual museum labels beneath them, saying "Maker Unknown." And the point of that display was to say that the makers weren't unknown. No one bothered to ask. And there was a great gap in history because of this. With Islamic art, it's not necessarily the same issue and cause as makers weren't asked. Makers really weren't known if you're dealing with several hundred years earlier in cases where the names weren't recorded. So Rachid Karachi is acknowledging them through these works to create an extraordinary installation, hundreds of panels, en masse, which won the Jamila Prize at the Victorian Albert Museum when it was first held as a competition to survey great innovative works within the heritage of Islamic art. The fifth Jamil Prize exhibition has just been announced in the London Galleries of Victorian Albert Museum, and six works are currently visible on the website. So it is my hope that one day Australia will see a follow-up to this exhibition in the museum, which could perhaps be the best of the Jamil Prize in its history. And that, I think, would be a way of addressing what we have here now, which is a triumph of the vernacular. I think we now need the spectacular to follow it. So thank you for your time. Okay.
Does anyone have any questions? Penny has a microphone.
Very good.
I was just interested in the Kaiomiya, because I did see your exhibition at the Albury Gallery a few years ago.
Thank you.
And I was interested in, is it surviving as a craft?
I think it is. Oh, right awesome. Now, the tent makers are showing their work in, or recently in Berlin and soon in Santa Fe at the folk art collections there, photograph collections. And it's really because of the patronage of quilters that I think this is really happening. Because in quilting, you see a like-minded audience that collects and respects the work for what it actually is and is willing to pay the prices required to keep the art form going. We're seeing tent makers returning to the craft who weren't left, who had gone to become taxi drivers and lawyers and other things. And we're seeing a new respect for the profession. Something else too, it's now seen as a way that young Egyptian men, or women as well, but mostly men, can learn a craft that gives them the chance to be seen and known overseas. If they're learning English and have a passport and their capacity to get an American visa, amongst other things, quite new worlds are opening to them through this craft. So I think it is surviving, but it's by no means guaranteed. And I think it's by no means yet finished changing. Kaiomiya is constantly in a process of change. Actually, I have one more slide here if it helps. That one, which is a piece that was shown in the Albury exhibition as well, the Milan panel, which uses the epigram which is most common on Kaiomiya: "Look again, you will see a beautiful work. And behold, I have shown you the proof. In Egypt, the beauties of every art, to reveal them, I need a long explanation." So quite a beautiful self-referential poem here, which we think may have its origins in a song from the Mawal genre, which described the streets of Cairo. So we're not quite sure, but we think that might be it, based on the cadence of the original Arabic. But thank you for your question. I hope that answered it.
Thank you very much for the lecture today. That was really fascinating. From my point of view, I was coming along looking for differences, and I've discovered a lot of detailed differences that you've explained, which was magnificent. I just wonder whether you could comment on the possibility of identifying more universal aspects of art that come from your study and the development of Islamic art over time that might be applicable throughout all types of art?
That's a really important question. And I think it's actually the one that really shaped the foundation of the study of Islamic arts in the work of people like Richard Ettinghausen and Oleg Grabar, who are seen as two of the major names. Oleg Grabar wrote his PhD thesis. He was the son of a Byzantine art historian, and he wrote his PhD on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa. But as we're looking at this structure, he used that as a starting point. And from there, he tried to find the principles that subsequently followed could be found in any piece of Islamic art that really started there as that first manifesto of Islamic art. Ettinghausen looked towards manuscripts and tried to find similar trails as he went from each text accordingly, in codicology, in binding, in illumination and text, and literature. And others have tried to do this with music as well, architectural spaces. But I think that perhaps the most valuable of the universal statements that come from Islamic art, first of all, you deal with the fundamental premise of what Islam is, which is universal, statements that define the five pillars, the statements that go along with this, and the ways of being that make you an individual who is Muslim. But within the art itself, I remember a conversation that was distilled down to just two sentences between Ettinghausen and Grabar. And Ettinghausen wrote, horror vacui, which is a fear of an empty space. The idea that we fill spaces with arabesque, with geometry, with ornament and pattern in Islamic art. And Ettinghausen then replied, in the short form, no, amor infinity, love of the infinite. And if you're looking for a universal element there, then the love of the infinite is also those geometries, the arabesques, the idea that any pattern goes into all directions infinitely. And it's the same principle taken from two directions, the fear of the absent, the love of the present. And I think that universalizing principle, amor infinity, horror vacui, that might be the main thing we can take from Islamic art. Is how do we situate that desire, to situate yourself against the universe? So I think that's where we might find an answer to your question, I hope. Thank you.
Could everyone please join me in thanking Dr. Sam for that? I told you you were in for a treat, didn't I? Thank you, Sam. I've really enjoyed that. I did laugh when you were talking about the fireplace in Adelaide. If anybody would like to know a little secret, if you've been to the National Library and out the front, over to the left, in what used to be a couple of bushes, is the Henry Moore sculpture. That was purchased. It was purchased to go directly in front of the National Library where the fountain is now, but someone got a bit confused about feet and inches and metres and centimetres, and they thought it was going to be a lot bigger. So when it arrived on site, everybody went, "What the? Where's the real one?" and just put it to the side. So that's why it's over to the left rather than directly at the front door. Of course, over the years, everyone fell in love with it, but there's a little bit of cheeky gossip for you. Now, this was the last in the lecture series. We've had such a good time putting this series together. We've had so much fun presenting it. We hope you've enjoyed it as well. The exhibition ends on the 22nd of July. It has to go home to the Vatican, which is a great shame. But on the 22nd of July, we have an event called the Souk. It's been put together with the United Arab Emirates Embassy, and it's going to have food and music and market stalls. It's going to be fabulous. So if you'd like to join us on the 22nd, you're more than welcome to. Oh, nice work, Penny. That was seamless, wasn't it? Yes, so thank you so much for joining us. I encourage you to go into the exhibition. Don't forget it's only on until the 22nd, so please come in and see it a few times if you need to. But join me in going completely crazy for Dr. Sam Barker.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.